We'll now call the November 29th regular meeting to the Chatham County Savannah Metropolitan Planning Commission to order. And we'll pause for our invocation and then we'll proceed into the Pledge of Allegiance. Amen.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you. The Metropolitan Planning Commission is holding hybrid meetings. Therefore, we will have participants that are also online as well as in person. And our meeting will move accordingly. Excuse me. The agenda is broken down into several parts. First, we have notices, then proclamations and acknowledgements. Next, the consent agenda, which consists of items for which the applicant is in agreement with staff recommendation and there are no known objections. This will be followed by regular business, old business, then adjournment. For each item on the regular agenda, the staff will make a presentation. The staff presentation will be followed by a presentation by the petitioner, should they elect to do so. The petitioner will be allotted a time frame of no more than 20 minutes. The board may then ask questions of the petitioner or staff for clarification. Afterwards, the floor will be open for public comment. Excuse me. If you wish to comment on the item that the board is considering at the time, members of the public that are in person must fill out a speaker card and give to staff. If you're participating virtually, you will use the raise your hand feature that is in the control panel on your screen. Do not use that feature until the item you want to comment on is being considered. At the appropriate time, you will be recognized and staff will unmute your microphone. And we also ask if you are online, we ask that you make sure that you have unmuted your microphone as well. At the end of the allotted time, as determined by the chair, your microphone will be muted and the chair will recognize the next speaker. Okay, the total public comment time will be equivalent of the petitioner's presentation time. Therefore, it is important that you use the raise your hand feature during the hearing on that item if you want to speak on a petition. Once the floor is closed for public comment on a petition, no additional public speakers will be allowed. If you're not certain you want to speak, still raise your hand, or if in person, fill out the speaker card. You will have the option to decline when your name is called. After public comment, the petitioner will have the opportunity for rebuttal and then additional needed questions by the board. Finally, the board will take action. Okay. So we'll go ahead and get into the meeting as scheduled. First there, we've done the invocation and the Pledge of Allegiance. Now we'll go into the approval of the agenda.
Cole's motion to approve the agenda.
Is there a second?
No, it's second.
All right. It's been properly moved and seconded. We'll do a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Okay. We'll move into the notes and proclamations and acknowledgments. There are none listed. Now we'll move into the items requested to be removed from the final agenda. Just for the record's sake, I'll read through them real quickly. Item number one is the map amendment at Wild Heron Road, rezone from A1 to A-1 to RMF-1 and RSF-4, and that petition number is 22-002692-ZA. Item number two is the master plan amendment at 1901 Benton Boulevard, petition number 22-003026. Item number three, a map amendment at 362 Fort Argyle Road, a rezone from A-1 to IL, and that petition number is 22-003510. Item number four, map amendment 12500 Apache Avenue, is a rezone from RSFE to BM, petition number 22-004-424-ZA. Item number five, special use permit at 12500 Apache Avenue. Request for an accessory alcohol sale by drink within a marina restaurant. Petition number 22-004-426-ZA. And item number six, map amendment at 340 Buckhalter Road, a rezone from RA County to RMF-1-2. And that's petition number 22-005-069-ZA. And again, those items have been requested to be removed from the final agenda. You take action.
Motion to remove items 1 through 6 from the final agenda.
Mr. Chairman, there is one more item that might be on the other side of your page.
Wow. No, that one is items requested to be withdrawn according to my agenda.
No, it's second.
All right. Thank you. Any, we'll do a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries and those items have been removed from the final agenda. Now we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, and that is items requested to be removed, requested to be withdrawn. And that item is a rezoning map amendment at 1800 East 63rd Street, a rezone from RSF 6 to RMF 2-20, and that petition number is 22-004421. Okay, we can take action.
Coles make motion to remove item 7 from the agenda. No, withdraw, sorry.
No, it's second.
All right, thank you. It's properly moved and seconded. We'll take a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. Motion carries and that item is withdrawn. Yeah, once I get through that. Okay, we'll move on to the consent agenda. The consent agenda consists of items for which the applicant is in agreement with the staff recommendation and for which no known objections have been identified nor anticipated by staff. Any objections raised at the meeting will result in the item being removed. I'm being moved to the regular agenda. At a 12:30 briefing, the staff will brief the commission on consent agenda items and the time permitting regular agenda items. No testimony will be taken from applicant supporters or opponents, and no votes will be taken at the briefing. Okay, so in this consent agenda, we have the approval of the October 18th, 2020 meeting minutes, as well as the 2023 calendar of meetings. Anybody, so we can take action, it would take a vote to approve the consent agenda.
Motion to approve consent agenda.
Second. So it's been moved and seconded. We'll take a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you. If anybody is online or present for any of the items that were identified in the items requested to be removed from the final agenda, the items to be withdrawn and or items in the consent agenda, if you are here, you can leave now that those items have been, you know, voted on, or you can stay at your leisure for the remainder of the meeting. Okay, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, and that is old business. There is none listed, so we'll move into the regular agenda, and that is the rezoning map amendment of petition number, and that's petition number 22-004383-ZA at Albion Street. Special use permit for a place of worship.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nirav Gandhi, MPC staff. So at issue today, we have a series of properties here at in the Woodville neighborhood. You can get a little bit of a placement here. This is Bay Street back here and 516 over there. So this series of properties here, the applicant is requesting the approval of a special use permit to operate a place of worship here. Here's an aerial of the properties. So the subject property is located on the south side of Albion Street. It's on the edge of the train tracks here. The property is currently undeveloped. The owner is requesting the special use permit to operate a place of worship here, which is required to operate a place of worship in a residentially zoned area. This area is zoned RSF6 for a residential single family. There are several homes in the neighborhood. However, many of the lots are undeveloped and are unlikely to be developed due to the layout of the neighborhood, as well as some canals, not, I wouldn't say canals, ditches more like, as well as wetlands. But the neighborhood has a little bit larger lots than is typical. So the houses are spaced out a little bit more. The applicant has spoken to the neighbors in the neighborhood here, and I spoke to a neighbor who was said he was representing the neighborhood about their concerns with this. They were actually pretty on board with it. The only thing they had asked is that the building be required to be set back about 100 feet from Albion Street. These are some pretty deep lots. This is actually about 130 feet just here, so there's plenty of room for them to do that. We have spoken to the applicant, and he was amenable to that. So that is going to be a condition on the approval of this special use permit, should the board choose to approve it. As I said, this is a residentially zoned property and surrounded on all sides by RSF6 zoning. Here's a street view of the property. So one thing we wanted to consider is if it was consistent with the neighborhood. We find that the placement of a small place of worship here, which is pretty much going to be a small church, would fit the intent of the zoning ordinance, as it fits in with the uses of these single family homes in the area with larger lots that are spaced out a little bit more from each other. Small places of worship are common and compatible with single family neighborhoods across Savannah. I'm sure you've seen many around. The place of worship also requires a 30-foot setback from residentially zoned properties, which, as I said, this lot is pretty large. There is a ditch back here, and this is actually considered public right-of-way. So that actually gives them plenty of room to place the building over here and still leaves plenty of room for parking in other parts of the lot, which would happen during the site plan process. We did not find that the proposed use would likely to be detrimental to the public good. It would be best for the main building to be set farther back, as we said, so as to cause the least possible intrusion to the aesthetic and the rhythm of the neighborhood. There will be noise during Sundays when it is most active, but it's unlikely that a place of worship would be creating active noise during the nighttime. We have also put in our special conditions that if there is any exterior lighting on the building or on the sign for the church, it will be downlighting so it doesn't disturb the neighbors at night. The current residential zoning district's main use, which is for single family homes, is not really desirable in this location due to its proximity to the train tracks here. A smaller place of worship does not really interrupt the neighborhood and is a good use for this property, we found. And we don't think it would be out of place in this specific neighborhood. Again, this neighborhood is largely undeveloped. There are 17 parcels between Division Street and this rail line, and only 4 of them have been developed with single family homes. So we feel like this would be a good addition to the neighborhood. We also want to make a comment that we will check on if there is a project going on with the train tracks here. There is a project going on with the train tracks, but we're not sure if it's going to affect this area or not. But we will be looking into it and definitely put that comment into our report when we take it to City Council. So with all that in mind, our recommendation is the approval of this special use permit request. We have 3 conditions on that. The first one is that the special use permit shall not be transferable. If anyone else ends up operating this place of worship, they would need to come back in front of the board and get that approved again. 2, that exterior lighting shall be downlighting so as to reduce the nuisance to the neighbors. And 3, that the main structure shall be set back a minimum of 100 feet from the front property line. So I'll ask any questions from the commissioners.
All right, thank you. Any questions, staff? Noah.
Thank you, Noah. How deep are the lots?
So this lot, I can pull up some exact measurements, but I know this lot itself is 130 feet deep. This is, I'm guessing, around 250 total. The back area of this is pretty wet. There's also like kind of a ditch running this way between this home and here, as well as some vegetative buffer. This is actually the neighbor I spoke to right here. And he's fine with it as long as, again, they kind of set it back a little bit from Albion Street specifically. They do have to keep it, again, because of the condition written into the ordinance about places of worship. It does have to be at least 30-foot setback on the side from his home anyway. So,
I guess my concern is there's, and I want to acknowledge the neighbor's request, but access to the rear of the building for emergency vehicles. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea to push this building all the way on the back lot. There's no access, it doesn't appear, from the rear that turns from a road into a ditch.
Yes, sir.
And I'd hate to try to do one good thing and then we're creating another problem. Just my concern that it's pushed too far back.
Sure. Yeah, and I do want to confirm this is a ditch. This is not a place that you could drive a car or even put up a dirt road.
It's both.
Okay. You mentioned that this one neighbor is in support of the project, but were there any letters of opposition or any comments from the other neighbors?
I received, excuse me.
Go ahead.
I received one call from another neighbor who was farther down the street, and she was in support of the project, but that was it.
Ms. Jarrett?
I wanted to ask about the ditch and whether there's any floodplains associated with the property. Is that going to be a problem for them in the future?
I did look at that. I don't believe it's going to be a problem for actually building on the property, but I would say that there may be a the ditches are, I don't know, that would probably have to come into play during the site plan process for them to work around that and make sure it's not going to be an issue, but there is not really a floodplain problem here.
Okay, so that little line that runs in the middle of the property, kind of just to the south.
Right here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that a ditch?
I don't believe so. I did take a walk around there, but I didn't see anything noticeable to my eye. But, it could be a bit of a depression there. There is definitely one running this way, and then there's one running
along
the back there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
It does look similar to the dark line in the middle. Does mm-hmm. look similar to the
yes, ma'am.
For the ditch as well.
Mr. Melder.
It looks like your map is representing this to be six parcels, but I thought it was just three.
It was three originally. The applicant had just had these three parcels, but we spoke to them, and after speaking to the neighbors about pushing it farther back, they were able to acquire the properties behind it. So it's this whole grouping now.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Anything else for staff?
And if y'all do want to change the setback that we've recommended of 100 feet or reduce it or anything, you are very free to do that. Just a reminder.
Thank you.
What is the normal setback required on the street?
That'd be 30 feet.
30?
Anything else for staff?
And the parking, and everybody's satisfied with the parking. And what is, I guess, better question, what is the parking requirement for a church of that size?
So that will depend on the number of seats essentially in the church, but what they're going to be required to do is create paved entryway and some paved handicap spots. There is an allowance for places of worship specifically to use a number of grass lots as well, unpaved, but they will certainly have to do some paving, especially for the handicap spots, and the handicap spots will need to have paved access to the entrance as well.
Do you take in consideration any allowance for on-street parking?
There could be on-street parking here as well. However, this is a really large lot, as I said, and there's going to be plenty of open space here, even in the front. I imagine that a lot of that grass area is going to be able to cover the parking needs of that church.
Mr.
Just to be clear, is this a once should the board move to approve the special use, will we be seeing this one again for just a master plan?
No, I don't believe so. This would just be this single time you see it, and then anything else would be handled by the City of Savannah Engineering for the site plan review.
Okay. Anything else for staff? All right. Thank you, Mr. Gandhi.
Thank you.
Okay. Petitioner.
Yes, he is here.
Okay. Do they wish to speak? Did they fill out a speaker's card?
I mean,
he doesn't have to. I mean,
okay. You're right then. You're fine. No worries. His English isn't.
Okay. Gotcha.
So,
gotcha.
No problem.
No problem. All right. Mr. Melder.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve staff recommendation on this item.
Hold up, I got to allow for the public right quick, though.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Sorry to be out of order, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any member of the public that wishes to speak on this petition? Anyone online, in person? Okay, no hands. Okay, cool. Mr. Melder, on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I would like to make a motion to approve staff recommendation on this item.
Kegler, second.
So a motion been made by Mr. Melder and seconded by Mr. Kegler to approve the petition as staff has recommended in their outline. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, hearing none, we'll enter a vote. Ms. Bowles, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Coleman?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Ms. Epstein?
Yes.
Ms. Jarrett?
Yes.
Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Mr. Noah?
Yes.
Mr. Notrika?
Yes.
Mr. Kegler?
Yes.
Mr. Wildwoody?
Yes.
And I too vote yes. Motion carries. And oh, Mr. Irvin's online. My apologies, Mr. Irvin. How do you vote?
I voted yes.
Oh, all right. Thank you, sir. All right. Motion carries and the petition is approved. All right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We'll move into the next item on the agenda, and as presentations, there are none listed.
Mr. Chairman, we actually do have a presentation that is not listed on the agenda, but it's something we discussed in the pre-meeting, and we're going to complete that discussion this meeting, if that's all right.
Please, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to be talking today or continuing our discussion about some proposed, probably potential is a better word, ordinance updates in the as it relates to the city and county zoning ordinances. There were always a few things that we identify throughout the year that we think need to be addressed. In all our ordinances, they have intent statements at the very beginning of the ordinance that talks about the purpose of the ordinance. And it's usually very long and very far reaching in terms of the goals and the things that it wants to achieve. But basically it really boils down to where and how development can occur in the jurisdiction. This includes zoning, it includes permitted uses, it includes standards and conditions, and all that is kind of laid out, you know, throughout the ordinance. So we're constantly evaluating all those aspects where this board is considering map amendments that are presented by petitioners or possibly by staff, or it's considering changes to the text to address some of these issues. So that evaluation is constantly happening by us, and we think it's necessary to address at times changing patterns that we see, needs and issues that may have been identified either by MPC staff or city or county staff or the public at large. Frankly, you know, we deal with on a daily basis and they bring things to our attention that we sometimes find are important to recognize. So what we're going to talk about today is kind of an overview of those issues that we've come across in the last few months, really. And so a little bit about how we got to this point. As I mentioned, some of these issues we're going to discuss today have been identified by staff Some we believe are errors or omissions to the ordinances. Some of this will come from stakeholder concerns. We deal with a lot of neighborhood associations, stakeholder groups, people in the business community, the development community, attorneys. And we also want to recognize some of the changes that we found in the development world, new trends from a building standpoint, types of housing, things of that nature, and then some procedural improvements on the way we operate. And it's a lot more to sort of each one of these issues than we can probably really cover in a single meeting. So this is going to be sort of a high level review. But each one of these that we're going to talk about is really an entity among to itself, and is going to take some significant, you know, staff time and work to get through. So we originally started out with the top five because we thought that sounded good, but we had to stretch that a little bit. So we're going to talk about each one of these topic items today, which are the site-specific rezoning process. That one will be specific to the city of Savannah. Our public notice procedures for Savannah and the unincorporated area. Historic development patterns, which has become a very hot topic of late, and I'll tell you a little bit about why that is and where we are with that. Parking requirements, which is kind of an ongoing discussion because it's so impactful in terms of both the cost of development as well as impacts on properties. We're going to talk about buffers and setbacks because these have become more important in our area as the scale of development has increased in the multifamily sector and the industrial sector. Not so much in the commercial sector. We're not seeing that like we did at one time in terms of big box stores. And that kind of, we're going to also talk about height, which is related to that, and then our procedures, really in this case specific to the Zoning Board of Appeals and to our submittal requirements and what we ask people to provide us to hear a given item. So first we'll talk briefly about site-specific rezoning. And some of you will recall, having been on this board, is that prior to 2019 in the city of Savannah under the old ordinance, there was a provision in that ordinance that allowed an applicant to come before this body and to city council requesting the rezoning of a piece of property specific to a site plan. And oftentimes, many times, applicants will come up here, they'll will present their rezoning requests, and they'll have something that resembles a general development plan as the idea of what they want to do on this given piece of property. But there's not a provision currently in the ordinance to tie them specifically to that. There is in the county ordinance and has been there for some time. It was taken out of the city ordinance when the new zoning ordinance was adopted, and it was really replaced with the plan development section. The kind of the issue with that is that the plan development section of the city ordinance is great for large scale redevelopment master plans, where you've got a series of different uses, something that's going to happen over a period of time. It's not as good for, you know, somebody who comes in with one lot that's 25 acres and they want to put apartments on it or a commercial use or whatever. The site-specific rezoning is very good for that because this body and then the council gets to decide on the zoning based on the development that is proposed. And if that development does not happen, then anybody else who wants to redevelop the property has to go back through the zoning process to either rezone it again as a different site-specific or just to a base zoning district. So there's a lot of value in that from the standpoint of giving some surety to the council, to this body, but more importantly to the public as to what's going to happen should a piece of property get rezoned under this procedure. So that's one of the things that we want to figure out a way to go back to. And really, it's just something that we feel like we can add to the ordinance as an option for people, for developers, for petitioners who want to, who are fairly certain, very certain of what they want to do and are willing to tie their approval to that. So we think there's a place where we can put this back in the ordinance and it'll be a valuable tool to ensure that things don't happen where you get up here, an applicant goes before council and they talk about the project that they want to do if they get rezoned, and then a totally different project happens on that property. And that's happened in the city on a few occasions, and it really puts everybody in a bad spot, the elected officials, us as staff, as well as the board, when you kind of give the public the feeling that, oh, you sold us a bill of goods on talking about this project that you wanted to do, and then either you sold the property or decided to develop it in a different way because the market changed. When the public generally, and I think somebody was talking about this earlier, Mr. Wildwoody, is not really in the weeds on zoning. They're not. And so if they're sitting in this meeting or listening online, and we're talking about, well, this person's going to build X, and then a year from now they look and it's Y, then, you know, they feel like they were wronged. So we think putting this back in the ordinance is a way to address that.
Mr. Lawson, may I interject for a second? As we go through this presentation, I know that there will probably be some questions that arise. That being said, would you prefer that we catch and throw the questions out in the at the end of the presentation of each section, or how would you prefer? Because
I would prefer if we held the questions to the very end, because some of these things are related. Okay. So if you just want to jot those down while we're talking, and then come back, there will be time at the end for questions, and we can go back to any of these sections to discuss that at that
cool
time.
Just wanted to didn't want to break your flow and continuity that. But at the same time wanted to make sure everybody had the opportunity to get their burning questions.
Absolutely. And we'll certainly do that. And this will just a little aside is that there'll be additional conversations that happen in more detail for each one of these with this board. So I just wanted to let that be known.
Correct. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. On the next slide, we're going to talk about is the public notice procedures. And this is one of the sort of key factors in how we communicate what happens at this board, primarily with the general public. We were talking earlier today about signs, about zoning and zoning board of appeals signs and the processes. And when, you know, the ordinances are written, there's a lot of time spent addressing what we believe is appropriate in terms of notification. So their minimum requirements that are part of the zoning procedures law, which we meet. And then there's additional requirements that the local jurisdictions can create. So the city and county have different requirements for notice. So we have to be diligent in terms of making sure we're addressing each one depending on the jurisdiction or what comes before you. The county essentially for zoning and zoning board of appeals meets the minimum requirement for state law for notice. One thing that the MPC has always kind of done as a policy matter is if we see a need to do extra, we just do it. It's not really written anywhere, but if we need to notice additional people or send out additional notice in terms of distance, that's usually done in those cases. Now, the thing about that is it's never perfect. And one of the things I'm going to talk about is property owners versus residents, because, you know, that's different in terms of notice. Signage, you know, we had a discussion on earlier. The signs that we use, you know, you can't put every detail about a petition on a sign that you stick on the side of the road. The intent of the sign is to notify the public that something is happening, not necessarily exactly what's happening, and then some contact information so they can call us up and say, okay, what's happening on, you know, this particular street. When we recently did, a few years ago now, the revised city ordinance, we did kind of go through, pick out many of the application categories and then say, okay, for this category, this type of notice is required, whether it be mailed, posted, published, or a neighborhood meeting or some combination of those. So for each notice type, we did identify that. However, admittedly, we didn't capture everything. So there are things, for example, master plan amendments are not included in that. So if in the city of Savannah, if somebody's amending a master plan, based on what the ordinance says, we don't technically have to provide notice, even though we do, but that's just a change that, you know, would make sense, in my opinion, to make. In terms of the neighborhood meeting procedures for the unincorporated area, it's a little more difficult because within the city, you have neighborhood associations broadly. The city has a great database of contact information. So if somebody's rezoning a property, for example, in the city of Savannah, there's usually a neighborhood association contact that we can make and allow the applicant to make and say, okay, this is the person you need to call to set up your meeting. It's not as organized in the county just because of the development pattern. It's harder to do that. But I think it's important for us to recognize that, you know, the neighbors that live in the county that are adjacent to something that happened, that's happening, you know, deserve notice as well, the opportunity to have a meeting as well, which is not currently required. But we have to figure out a way from an equity standpoint to make that happen, because the especially a lot that's happening in West Chatham, for example, the residents are spread out. So you can't necessarily say, okay, we're going to contact people within a certain distance, because that might not make sense. You might only capture a handful of people. So we really need to work on a way to say, okay, in these circumstances, here's how we're going to handle neighborhood meetings in areas that don't have organized neighborhood associations. So that's a big piece, because it's going to involve spending some time figuring out the geography of those areas in terms of making contacts and things of that nature. It may not necessarily be through associations like we have it in the city. Maybe it's through organizations, you know, maybe it's through religious organizations or business organizations. So we still have to figure that out, but we think it's important and worth doing. So I think I kind of touched on this, but there are some application types that don't require any notice. Some of those are probably fine. Something like a traffic impact analysis isn't going to necessarily, you know, you need to have a public hearing about, but there are others that probably do. And I think we want to amend the notice procedures to reflect that. You know, the owner versus resident issue has come up before. When we send out notices per the regulations, we send them to the property owner. We've got the database of all the addresses, so we write a letter. But that property owner could be in Kalamazoo, right? They own a property in Savannah or in the unincorporated area, but they live in New Jersey or California, or I've sent letters to Australia, frankly. But oftentimes what happens is when the sign goes up or the word gets around on social media, a person who's renting a home, for example, will call us up and go, I didn't get notified. Well, when you talk about, do you notice the owner? Do you notice the resident or both? You know, of course it makes sense to notify as many people as you can, but there are costs associated with that. So that's part of it. So that's something that we have to consider. And then we have to continue to recognize changes to the state zoning procedures law, because there were some recent changes this past session regarding notice for public hearings. On historic development patterns, there's been a lot of discussion of late with the preservation community in Savannah about the fact that in the historic district in particular, it's not only the buildings that are important to the fabric in terms of the Oglethorpe plan, but the layout of the lots themselves. We had a big meeting here several weeks ago with some folks who became interested in a particular project that was subdividing a lot and building a house on it. So just as a quick overview, the issue really is that when you've got a lot, and in particular, we were talking about tithing lots, and these are lots that are abut squares and usually have a lane on the rear. If you think about dividing that lot horizontally, now you still have the main house, say, on the square, and now you've got this lot on the lane side. Typically, that would be for an accessory building, a carriage house, what have you, and there'd be a courtyard in between. But that pattern doesn't exist all over downtown anymore. It's just, you know, that pattern is in many places has been changed. But what you end up with is now you've got a second principal lot that if it's on the corner, it's on the lane on one side and on the street on the other side. So what that means is you can build a house on it under the current regulations. So instead of a main house and a carriage house, now you've got two main houses, which could be three stories or whatever. And you've got that on a lane, which is an issue from a preservation standpoint, as I understand it. When we get into this, we'll certainly bring the preservation experts in here to talk to you about this. But one of the things that we've been discussing is kind of the relationship between that issue and the subdivision regulations. Because right now, if somebody comes in and files that exact kind of subdivision, I'm going to be reviewing that from the standpoint of do these lots meet the minimum size requirements and those kinds of things. and not from the standpoint of, does it impact the Oglethorpe plan? So we think these things need to kind of get married and figure out a way to ensure that we're not negatively impacting that pattern. Next thing is the parking minimums, which, you know, we, as I said, continue to kind of evaluate. We've been involved in a number of parking studies in the city of Savannah over the last couple of years. One thing that we did in the city is kind of with the new zoning ordinances, we did reduce a lot of the parking minimum requirements. There's lots of areas that, you know, historically have been overparked, especially sort of, you think about Southside Savannah, you know, with lots of shopping centers and those kinds of things. Those kinds of places are parked the way they are because of the regulations that were in place, and they're probably full 2 days a year. So when we looked at the new zoning ordinance, we did limit the parking requirements in a lot of areas, and we kind of standardized the parking for multifamily to one per unit. And, you know, there's the issue, as we saw it, was that if a developer is coming in and they're going to build an apartment complex, or they're going to build a shopping center or a medical office, those kinds of developers usually have a very good idea of their need from a parking standpoint versus what's required. So we felt like sort of standardizing the requirement would allow things to not get overparked, but provide enough parking in the event that the applicant, you know, did not. So, for example, in the unincorporated area for multifamily, there's a sliding scale of parking requirement based on the number of bedrooms. So a studio versus a three bedroom has a different parking requirement. So for a individual development, you have to do that calculation to figure out, okay, we got 25% studios, we got 20% one bedrooms, we got so on and so forth. And then based on those units, your parking requirement would be calculated. That's probably no longer an efficient way to calculate parking. So those are one of the things that we want to look at. And it may not be one per unit in the unincorporated area. It might be a different number because, you know, people are more likely to use cars the further you go out. But there is some understanding, I think, that for certain uses, fewer people are using a car every day in certain parts of the city in the unincorporated area. When you think about hotels as an example, I think most of us, if you travel and you're going to a hotel, you're probably not taking your own personal car as much as you are using either ride shares or other services. So those things have to be considered. The next item we really want to talk about is required buffers. Required buffers, as they're written in both of our ordinances right now, are probably inadequate in some areas. The example I pulled up here is just one from the ordinance that's really our most stringent buffer. So for example, and we've seen this example impact folks, if I've got an industrial use that's being developed next to a single family residential neighborhood, the maximum required buffer is 40 feet. So 40 feet, you think about 40 feet, that's, you know, not this, the width of this area right here, probably. The requirements do tell you what you have to plant within that buffer, whether there's a fence required in that buffer. So those things are there. But the issue is that the scale of development now is different from when these requirements were written. Million square foot warehouses are very common now, very common, and they're getting bigger. They're not getting smaller. So with that, when the scale increases, you have to increase that distance in order to maintain an appropriate buffer. There was a time when almost nobody in Savannah was building apartments taller than three stories. That's not really the case anymore. Apartment development has grown in scale, and it's been probably the second hottest sort of area in terms of construction in town. Next to industrial. So when you've got those kinds of scale of development, you have to, I think, have the buffer requirements reflect that to protect the existing neighborhoods and strictly also existing single-family residentially zoned property, because at some point, you know, that property could be developed. So, you know, often we've seen impacts based on the minimum buffer requirements be there. And frankly, most examples that we've seen, you know, they're going to do the minimum requirement, because then that gives them additional property for their development. So there's not that many examples of people going, oh, I'm willing to do more. So we're going to have to codify it so that it's there. And sort of related is this issue of height. Height of residential dwellings is, like I said, it's kind of relative. You think about, especially in the multifamily world, prior to the change in the city, the maximum height was 36 feet. In 36 feet, it's very hard to get a three-story building unless it's got a flat roof, which, you know, if you're trying to do anything interesting architecturally, that becomes very difficult. So we saw lots and lots of variance requests for height. And frankly, we even saw variance requests for that height for single-family residential in the unincorporated area, where you often have larger homes on larger lots. So that standard still exists in the unincorporated area. So we think in particular for multifamily, we're probably going to have to look at that in the unincorporated area, because almost every multifamily development that comes to us in the unincorporated area requests a height variance, because you just can't do much with 36 feet. And that really, as I understand it, that requirement goes way back. Really, it's about fire protection. One of the things that happened is that we didn't have the ability in the past, and Mr. Noah can probably speak to this, to fight a fire on a building taller than that with the equipment that was available at the time, but I think that's less of an issue now. The other thing that's happened in that world is that the cost to put in elevators is a lot less than it used to be. So it's not uncommon for a residential multifamily building to be four stories or even three with an elevator. I think the development community believes there's value in that from that standpoint, and they will they do that more often than they used to. And lastly, a little bit about the Zoning Board of Appeals. One of the things that we have identified lately is that there has to be a relationship between the order that things come when they have to be heard by multiple boards. So if an item is required to, say, be approved by the Historic Preservation Commission or the Historic District Board of Review, and it also requires a variance, in the past, what we've done is if somebody files a variance request, they would go to ZBA, the ZBA would rule on it, and if they approved it, then they would go to the review board. The review board is now put in a little bit of a situation by having an approval coming to them from another body. So we think that should probably go in the other order, and that's something that we're going to look at from a policy standpoint to address. The information that's required for submittals has always been an ongoing issue. We talked about it a little bit with the site-specific rezoning piece. It's not just the accuracy and the completeness of the information, but the requirement. So if somebody's coming to this body and they're making a request, we have to just make sure that we've got ample information from them in order to bring it to you, so that you can make a decision on it. And then the appeals process, there's not a lot there, except the only thing we really want to do is clarify for the public within the ordinances what the process is, because all most people know is, well, if I go to the ZBA and get denied, that's a quasi-judicial body, so that appeal is heard by Superior Court. But beyond that, they don't know what to do, where to go, how to handle it. So we think it's that we can put that somewhere and make that information available, as well as the sort of issue of standing that comes up often. You know, who has standing to appeal a particular decision. So we want to, that's really about clarifying, I think, some information, and those are the things that we want to do when it relates to that body. So with that, I'll stop there and take any questions from the board.
Thanks, sir. Ms. Jarrett.
Okay, I have a few questions. The site specific in particular, didn't we have that in the zoning NUZO and it was taken back out again?
And it's been a long time, Ms. Jarrett, but I think you're right about that. As I recall, we had that in the, or we just kind of brought it over from the old ordinance into the new ordinance. And then at some point when we started having the discussion about the plan development districts, we created that, the large and small plan developments for less than 3 or more than 3 acres. And then we, based on creating that, we eliminated the site specific. But I think they can both really exist and are both needed. Because, like I said earlier, the planned development district is appropriate for certain types of developments, but not really great for single-use developments, which this is much better for.
Okay. Now, as far as the site-specific goes, the tree preservation was one of those things that I know, at least in one of the sites that we looked at, was discussed, and they assured us that they would take care of the trees. And I have seen that they have chopped trees in the middle, which is not what an arborist would recommend or suggest. How can we make sure that they follow their what they say they're going to do as far as?
Yeah, that's an issue with trees and with a lot of other things, because the within the process, once a zoning is adopted by the council, even in, say, let's say a site-specific zoning, then that developer petitioner is going to submit a site plan. It's going to get reviewed, and at some point it'll get approved. And then there'll be issued permits to go out there and start digging up the dirt and building and et cetera. So once that starts, there's an inspection process by lots of people, Greenscapes being one of them, that they go through as the development is happening and inspect the site to make sure that they're following the plan. Now, it doesn't mean that things can't happen on site while contractors are working, because that's usually what happens, is that things get done and then it's something that can't be undone, like taking a tree down that you weren't supposed to take down. The only thing you can really do is have them mitigate for that, but you can't put back a 100-year-old tree. All you can do is either pay a penalty or replace trees elsewhere. So I think that's the issue, is that during the development process, you know, things can happen that are not part of what was approved, but once they're done, you can't undo them.
Especially with the trees.
That's a great example.
Right on Bull Street, I'm very concerned about their construction fencing is right up against the trunk of the tree.
And I will say this, is that it's typical in my experience that the city's greenscape division does work, especially in the midtown, downtown areas where you have lots of street trees that are on city property, to protect those trees. Now, trees can be pruned, and they do oversee that. They will allow that based on the health of the tree. So it may not be the most attractive thing. But
the way they pruned these trees was not the correct way to do it, from what I was taught early on.
I see.
Oh, Ms. Jarrett, just to follow up a little bit more on this tree issue, because I've dealt with it in several communities. And when we come back with this, we're going to come back with some best practices. In general, when you are when you have a site, especially a heavily wooded site, there's a statement about like no clear cutting until there's been a tree survey, for example. If there's trees on there, you can at least kind of condition or have the applicant put some notes on there that they're going to do their due diligence with regards to that before they start moving forward with their permitting. So there is a way to do it so that it's fair to the developer and the applicant, but it's also taking consideration concerns from people in the community. And I've had a number of folks reach out to me about the tree issue, even the trees that are located like on the back of sidewalks. You know, people have sent trees, you know, pictures saying this is what this should look like, but this is what it is now because there's been paving. You know, either the city has paved all the way up to the curve, and so you know you have no more you know, grass. So there are a couple issues that we can at least bring back, and we'll have some best practices and then use that as a source to move forward. But we do need to address that more specifically and have that tied to the zoning, because it's really difficult afterwards.
Understood. To do anything. So do you want me to go through all my list or just
go for it?
Okay. As far as the notice goes, I really feel like 300 feet is inadequate, specifically in the county, but also in the city as well. I mean, 300 feet is just not very far. And I
will say this to that point is that, and I don't want to, I'm going to say 10 years ago, probably, it used to be 200 feet. And then, you know, there was a lot of discussion about this issue of notice, particularly at that time in the city of Savannah. And I think the council at that time started discussing 500 feet and some other numbers. And frankly, the cost is a factor in that, because every time you add another 100 feet, you're adding, depending on where you're at, some number of additional people that have to be noticed, right? So it ended up landing on 300 feet. And that's just kind of where it stuck. I think there can be some evaluation of that number, maybe as it relates to other communities. We are exceeding the minimum requirement, but.
Oh, my vote is greater.
Yeah, I understand. And I think there may be circumstances where, you know, the number doesn't have to always be the same, depending on where you are from a density standpoint. Greater number might be warranted in an area where the population is much less dense.
Understood. The other thing that concerns me, and I don't think we really addressed it here, is the level of requirements that are needed before you come to MPC. Like, you know, how much is the drainage looked at, more particularly the traffic? Right. Now, we approve projects before the traffic study has been done, and that really concerns me, because as you were talking about the historic preservation people having an issue with ZBA approving something on the front end, mm-hmm. and I think the reverse works as well. You know, it would be a lot harder for a developer to be stopped after they've gotten MPC approval. And if we don't have the traffic information on the front end, and it's just, well, we're going to let the city and the county work that out. Mm-hmm. The city and the county are under all this pressure because MPC has already approved the project.
Right. And for, you know, the traffic study example is a good one. And I think one of the things that's important about that is that the intent of the traffic study is to come up with recommendations for improvements that the applicant is going to have to make. So from our standpoint, from a planning standpoint, we think those improvements are going to have to be made at some point, regardless, in order to get the project done. But to your point about having to rule on it before having the information does make it more difficult for this commission. Now, I think there has to probably be some agreement from the governing bodies about what we're going to require people to provide prior to having a hearing, because again, and I know I keep harping on that, but that really goes from the developer standpoint to cost. So what they're trying to do is figure out whether they can get zoning or not before they start diving into the
but the cost is either to the community or to the developer, in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
And at one time, the ordinance, I think there was some language in it that talked about a traffic impact study based on the number of units that was going to be requested. And again, I think that that's something we do need to look at, and we do probably need to tie it to something. If it's 50 units, that's not that big of a deal. But, you know, we're getting larger and larger
Agree.
Development requests. And we need to look more at the quality of the roads. It's just getting into more, providing more information. Generally, you would look at what the level of service for that road is. If the road is already, over – traveled, mm-hmm. then there needs to
like
be
like the Ogeechee Corridor.
Like the Ogeechee Corridor is a perfect example. You know, that you know, the state might tell you or local might tell you it's a level of service, you know, C or D, but you know, I'd say it's an E just based on the amount of traffic that I've seen on there. But those are things that I think we will get more into as we're dealing with our staff reports. But those are things that we at least need to have some threshold in the ordinance that says if you have more than X number of units, you know, you can do a soft one. You don't have to go all out and spend a lot of money to do a true traffic study, but you can have a general idea about what that impact is going to be on the site. And
agreed.
And we would look at that, and we would look at that working with the city or the county, because their staffs can look at that ahead of time. If you know that it's going to be a significant impact, then you condition that as part of the zoning. So when the development plan comes in, it's not, there's at least some minimum threshold that's put in place of what they need to do. So there's ways to do that. And again, that would be one where we would say the best practice to show you should do A, B, and C. And then the board can, you know, help with regards to advocating, talking to the elected officials about what should, what we should be doing if there's an issue or concern with them. And this is not going to be something we're doing with our head in the sand. We're going to make sure that we talk with the home builders, especially and other folks in the community, even the realtors, just because they need to know as you're out selling land. But it's something that does have an incredible impact, and it, and these are issues that come up when we have rezoning requests, especially for these large planned developments out in the county and the city, especially when they impact both jurisdictions.
Yeah, development in the floodplain too is something that we need to pay attention to. I know we had one project come through and it was receiving positive comments, but it was, portions of it were in the floodplain, and I think it went back to the drawing board because,
well, that would be something in that case that the city would, I mean, honestly, there's some minimums with regards to development in the sub in the floodplain and whether they're going to, you know, what their requirements are for elevation. That's where, you know, if we had something that was more specific, we could ask that there be, you know, an overlay that shows what the topography and the floodplain information is on the map. So we've got a list of things that we need to kind of start adding and start looking at. Some of the things that we, you know, we will start doing at beginning of next year is just looking in a little bit more detail. But there's other things like the floodplain. That's up to the city and the county to make those final determination, because it's going to be, overall, it's going to impact them. It'll impact their drainage and some other things that happen along the lines.
I think it might be a good idea at some point next year, just from a standpoint of gathering information, to have either the city or the county's floodplain managers come in to have a discussion with the board about what the process is, because you can build in a floodplain, but it's just a matter of, you know, impacts and how you do it and what's required. I think it would be good to have that information made available to the board so that you can reference it for future discussions about zoning and development.
And if we could consider other environmental impacts other than water and the floodplain, because we have had industries come before us who have described their impact as zero. And I would venture to say that if you're zoned as an industrial, if you are an industry, that you're going to have some impact other than an environmental impact, or you would not be zoned industrial, right? Sure. So so if we could think about other environmental impacts as well, air, water.
Very good point.
And the only other one that I had was, I think you mentioned it, the appeals by individual property owners that are not the applicant in the Zoning Board of Appeals. I know that was a sticky situation that Zoning Board had recently, where we had an individual who was appealing a decision that was made, and he was not the property owner, and he kind of got put off. So,
I think the issue of standing, and that's what Ms. Jarrett is referring to, is an important issue. And we've had that issue addressed by both attorneys over the years, and recently by the city attorney. And usually when we've got a question about whether a person who's filing an appeal has standing, what'll happen is the city staff or the county staff will take it to their respective attorneys and ask them, does this person have standing to appeal? And they'll make a ruling on that, and that person can, you know, accept the ruling or fight it in whatever means they have. But
the challenge is, and I've had a lot of discussion with the city attorney about this. This is the first place I've ever been where someone says you have to have standing to appeal a decision. I mean, it's a public document. If someone has concerns about a decision that was made using a particular policy, then they've got a right to appeal that decision. That if they're, if, you know, if it's not something that's realistic, then that's what the BZAs are for, to make those determinations. But I've never been in a place where someone said you had to have standing to appeal something that has an overall impact, because that appeal really impacts everything. It's not just that one area. Once a decision is made, that decision is made. So there's going to be more discussion on that. I know I've talked with the city attorney at length, and you know, he says it could go either way, honestly. But it is something that we need to get cleared up. You know, if the city wants to use that as a criteria, then we need to have more specific information about how it's used as the criteria, so that we can be fair as when applying it.
Anything else for staff?
One quick thing on the notice signs, as far as public notice goes, would it be possible for MPC to start adding QR codes so that people have an easy way to get directly to the petition? Because our website has a lot of information on it that layman wouldn't be able to really figure through. And I think a QR code is very
easy. I think that's a brilliant idea. I mean, we use them in other areas of our day-to-day lives, I'm sure. That's just something that we'll have to discuss with the city and the county, because they provide the signs. So that'll have to be part of whatever that printing process is for that company that produces them. But we can certainly have that conversation with both jurisdictions.
And we can put the QR codes on our website. In fact, it probably would be easier if a QR code was generated when they picked up their application, so that it can be replicated on the sign, as well as us being able to put it on the website and everything like that. But that will be discussions that we'll have to have with both the city and the county.
I think it's a good idea, but I don't want to dive too deep in it, but I do want to make mention of the QR codes. I think it will be effective. However, we just got to still make sure these the access is equitable, because not everybody is tech savvy, nor do they have the technology to be able to acknowledge some of these, access some of these things. So it's just a note for us to keep in mind as we keep try to come up with the different ways of making sure we do our due diligence to communicate.
And I think the other thing too that I've been looking at is talking with, I've had general conversation with the city PIO, but as they advertise a lot of upcoming meetings, it would probably be helpful if on their on television, you know, some of the folks have access to that there's a QR code that at least takes you to, if it's a zoning thing, it takes you to the zoning. If it's MPC agenda, at least it will take you to the agenda. So there have been some discussions with regards to having it in multiple places so that it's equitable, because not everybody has internet, but most people have a phone. You know, we want to do whatever we can do to try to make it easier for people to get access to our information.
Agreed. And one last add on the idea. If we look at QR codes being placed on actual sign postings for people to be able to go scan, I think we should also make sure that from a safety standpoint, that we consider where the signs are being placed so that we don't create road hazards by people stopping to get out and scan a QR code. Yeah. So it's just a couple of small things here and there that can make it effective or absolutely catastrophic.
Yep, good point. Good point.
And then, on zoning or rezoning, does the community have an opportunity to weigh in on how a vacant property is zoned? Because we've had issues where community members have decided that they're going to fight every industrial development at a site. So is there an opportunity for them to weigh in? Does MPC or the city consider how many oppositions have come up on a particular site and decide maybe it should be rezoned?
You mean rezoned to, like, say, for example, downzone a piece of property? I see what you're saying. Well, I would say this is that the rezoning process, and I'm preaching to the choir, but this is for the public if anybody's still listening, is usually either initiated by the property owner or the council or commission. I think that a neighborhood association, a stakeholder group, could certainly petition, probably starting with their elected official, about a particular property if that were the case. And if the jurisdiction found that it was important to rezone that property to protect something, then they certainly have the authority to do that. So I think the thing that those groups would want to do is to express their concerns to their elected officials and express their desire to protect whatever it is they're trying to protect, whether it's a neighborhood, from the impacts of zoning, of existing zoning. Right. The only other thing that I would say would probably be probably more effective is to make those same, make the request to those same folks about things like increased buffers and other protections that would allow a piece of property to be developed without having a negative impact on adjacent properties.
I was thinking too, thank you for that. And I was thinking in conjunction with the comp plan, for example, where we're looking right. much further down, mm-hmm. it's an opportunity to consider change in zone.
Yes, absolutely.
And I will note that we have to be very careful here in Georgia about doing that. Neighborhoods can make a request, but we have to look at the legalities of what they would like it to see. I just tell people if there's a vacant piece of property beside you, behind you, across the street from you, if you don't own it, it can be anything. And they have a right to come to the public meetings to express their concerns about whatever's been proposed for development on that site. And that's why some of the site-specific plans is going to help, to me, the community, that along with the increased buffers. But when you start talking about the city rezoning something or the county, there are some additional consequences that deal with the legal process, you know, that they have to factor in and make sure that it is not considered a taking. So there's a, that's more complicated than you might think.